taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is Caitlin. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am okay. How about you, Mark?
Well, I'm in a good mood because I get to talk about video games with you, but apparently that's not enough to raise your mood. So clearly I am more committed to Sparkle Motion than you are. Now, let us talk about some video games. We're going to talk about what we've been playing lately. We're going to talk about a retro game in our goof segment, Gaming Opinions on Old School Funware, specifically Secret of Evermore, which is our random collection of nouns for a Square RPG in the 90s. We're going to talk about our feature game, which is Hyper Light Drifter. And finally, we're going to close out the show, as we always do, by engaging in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles in our shout segment. So, Caitlin, what have you been playing lately?
So, honestly, I've just been playing some more Metaphor ReFantazio. I honestly don't even know what I can talk about without getting spoilery, but just continuing to trek along. I had a lot of work this week, so I didn't get to do very much else.
Are you enjoying your time with the mod squad?
Yes, I love them all very much, and I'm excited to continue to see what they do next. What those crazy kids get up to.
I'm kind of stuck at a boss, but despite that, I'm actually kind of enjoying it. I've played the same boss encounter now about 4 or 5 times.
And
I've been making progress. I've been getting closer and closer to completion. Part of it is my being stubborn. I want to clear the boss with a specific party setup because I now have members that I want to level up. And in Metaphor ReFantazio, this isn't really much of a spoiler, once you get your bonds high enough with a party member, they earn experience points at an equivalent rate, whether they're in the party or not. I assume you've already passed this threshold with some of your party members.
Yeah, okay.
And I haven't crossed this threshold with all of my party members, and so naturally that leads to a sort of ideal or optimal party setup, right? You have all the people earning full XP in the background, you have all the people that need more XP in the foreground. And so I mostly, in a stubborn pursuit of optimization, wanted to clear the boss with those people. I don't know that I'm going to be able to pull that off. I don't know that they're up to snuff, frankly.
I see. That's too bad.
It is too bad. But I think that highlights one of the things that I think is we didn't emphasize enough in Metaphor ReFantazio. It really is the case that when you encounter something challenging or you encounter a setback, you do have substantial things that you can modify in terms of overcoming specific combat challenges. And that's really cool.
Yeah, I really like that it doesn't feel like there's only one way to accomplish most things in this game.
The way that I mean it, maybe this is a difference in how we're playing it, is that there is a right way to do it. It's just that you're not stuck with a certain party composition in order to do that. So there's a certain broad set of tricks and tools that your party is going to need to be able to do in order to overcome a specific thing. Like, for example, there's one, you encounter a boss that's just invulnerable to everything except a very small list of things. And in another RPG context, like in a Persona game, for example, and look, I'll defend Persona games frequently, but in a Persona game, that would mean that you had to have a very specific party composition, namely the party members that can deploy that element type. But in Metaphor ReFantazio, any party member could theoretically deploy that element type, so long as they're spec'd properly, and you can respec them with relative freedom.
Yeah, I think last week, I believe I mentioned, one of my friends walking over while I was playing and being like, oh, wow, they're a healer. That's an interesting choice, but it's a choice I can make.
It is nice, and it does let me engage in some suboptimal stubbornness in terms of trying to insist on the quote-unquote optimal party composition. I should really just go over it and swap them around. It's tricky. Just out of curiosity, what is your... Because this is one area, actually, where the flexibility of Metaphor kind of messes with my headcanon a little bit. Because I do have this idea that The main character who, at least in various moments of the Rube Goldberg meta plot, which is admittedly kind of stupid of Metaphor ReFantazio, I kind of have the idea that they should be something in particular. Like that there's some sort of default job or archetype that they should aspire to. Are you in any way burdened by this neurosis?
Yes. Okay. I mean, first of all, I've been putting a lot of points into magic for the main character in Metaphor ReFantazio. And I mostly have been playing him as his main archetype that he unlocked. But, you know, somebody who's kind of hybrid, but mostly a caster.
Yeah, the way it works with other people is that when every time they level up, they get two semi-random stats leaning towards their preferred stats. The main character gets one random stat and then another stat that you can put wherever you like. And indeed, smart money appears to be you just dump it always into magic. So by the end of it, he's got a magic stat that's easily, you know, four, sometimes even five times as much as some of his other stats. Because, yeah, you want to be able to cast and do a lot of damage at the time of. Have you experimented with the merchant classes?
So I don't know that I've unlocked anything beyond the first one, but I've played the first one. Like, merchant, I think I've gotten to level 20 or at least pretty close, at level 20 being the cap. And it's so weird. I kind of hate it. Like, I feel like it doesn't... I hate the idea that I have to spend money to hit things. Even if I have a lot of money, it stresses me out for some reason.
Okay.
And actually, it's similar with Brawler. Like, spending hit points to deal damage also stresses me out. So both of those classes are difficult for me. But the only time that I really bring Merchant out so far is if I need to deal with a Mimic, because Mimics are terrible.
Okay, so first of all, with respect to the Merchant, it's all about the passive, though.
I already forget. What's the passive again?
Oh, wow. Here's the thing. Okay, and in fairness, this is one of those instances, I rag on this in games all the time, where they don't do a good job of communicating what's going on.
Yeah.
Because a number of other RPGs have had merchant archetypes of various types. Like Final Fantasy has done that a couple times in other games. And it's usually like, okay, well, you earn more gold than you would normally. And normally it's something like 10%, 20%, 25% maybe. In Metaphor ReFantazio, if you're a merchant, you earn so much more money than you normally would. It is egregious, the factor by which you earn more money. The problem is, you have to pay attention to the status results every time you kill something on the Overland map to notice that you're earning colossal quantities of bank.
And oh, so the main character, is it the main character has to be merchant?
Yes.
This? Okay, I don't think I've used merchant with him yet, so that...
Okay. Because yeah. I have spent a long time with the main character as a merchant, and you get so much money, it's amazing. In point of fact, I've been bending over backwards trying to max out the relationship with the character that unlocks further levels of the merchant class, just because I want to get back to the merchant class because it's so remunerative. And at that point, which goes to the second issue, and one of the reasons why I kind of like Brawler as well as Merchant in terms of their attacks, I agree with you that spending money for attacks isn't great, but it certainly beats spending SP, because in Metaphor ReFantazio, just like the Persona games, SP is your most precious resource. Yes, it regenerates between dungeons, but in the middle of a dungeon, it determines how long you're going to be able to adventure, and it's a hard cap in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there was one dungeon where I switched the main character over to mage, I think, because then I could get some magic back by killing things on the overland area, and I mean, that was a very stressful dungeon. I was running incredibly low most of the time, and my only hope was just run through and try to hit as many things as possible to gain MP back. But yeah, that was rough.
But imagine in the same context if you could be drowning in money and items from that.
I know, that does sound intriguing. Yeah, I keep forgetting that the main character has, like, gets some extra bonuses for stuff that he does on the main map that others don't get.
Yeah, some of the passives are better than others, and some of the passives are more transparent than others. And mm-hmm. I would encourage everyone not to sleep on the merchant class. It's very, very remunerative. Especially in those areas where, you know, between major fights, you might just be killing 10 low-level mobs just on the Overland map in the quasi-action RPG segment. And during that time, earning vastly more cash is great. Sometimes, actually, I don't even want to level up the merchant class, but I've switched to the merchant class just because I know that I see a whole bunch of easy mobs that are going to go down quick, so I might as well get some cash in the process.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially because you don't tend to get a whole lot of experience for killing them, so
no.
You might as well rake in some money.
There you go. I'm glad I was able to impart some knowledge, Caitlin.
Yeah, thank you. What have you been playing lately, Mark?
Well, it's been somewhat of a disappointing week. I've been bouncing around a couple of things, and I played 20 Minutes Till Dawn. It is another Survivor-type game. Apparently, this is what games that are like Vampire Survivors are called now, Survivor-type games. As opposed to Survival games, which are mostly about crafting and starvation, these are Survivor-type games. I don't know. I find taxonomies alternately tiresome and illuminating. This apparently is the terminology that we're kind of settling on for these kinds of things. I was intrigued because it was highly rated, but at the same time, a friend of mine had left a negative Steam review for it. And this friend of mine does not review things on Steam very often and reviews things negatively far less often. But nonetheless, it was around $5 on a sale, so I picked it up. And $5 is roughly what I want to spend on a Survivor game. QV, Halls of Torment, Vampire Survivors, Karate Survivor, you name it. And this is the first time I've bounced off of one of these types of games real hard. Even at the best of times, Survivor games can get a little sort of turn your brain off, just have a wash of colors and sounds across your screen, and maybe sometimes kind of sort of start to nod off. But 20 Minutes Till Dawn, I had that sort of detachment far, far sooner than most. And part of that is the overall visual aesthetic of 20 Minutes Till Dawn. The graphics are very bland. It's got kind of this quasi monochrome kind of effect where everything is just shades of gray. And on top of this, there's only about two or three different kinds of enemies that you might encounter on a 20 minute level, punctuated by the occasional boss, of course. But even other very low budget Survivor games have more visual variety than that. I mean, even Vampire Survivor, which just has very lo-fi graphics, tends to vary things up visually with a greater degree of frequency than that. On top of that, the bland and sort of undersaturated color palette makes differentiation very difficult. Like, all the summons you have, all the abilities you have, like rotating blades that surround your character or whatnot, are the same color palette as all your enemies. And so it becomes very, very difficult to distinguish where it is safe to walk. The projectiles of your enemies are all bright red. That is fine. That's cool. I know what to move away from. But when the things that are doing damage for you are the same color as the enemies that are on the screen, and there's a lot of them on the screen, that's not great. And I found it very difficult to tell where I was supposed to go. The hook of 20 Minutes Till Dawn, at least for me, was because, not entirely unlike Halls of Torment, it kind of sort of operates like a twin stick shooter. You're moving around with the left stick, you're aiming with the right stick, and you're firing a projectile weapon. And there's a lot of different projectile weapons in 20 Minutes Till Dawn, but the problem is, none of them are very good. Like, I'm not saying that the game is too hard. It's just that your very early game pickups that are common across all characters, like the rotating blades, like the ghost that shoots bullets for you, like this, that, or the other, I find that even on initial pickup, many of them are vastly more potent than your starting gun. And so by the time you've got two or three of these, your gun output is a drop in the bucket. And so consequently, I find it very hard to pay attention or care much about where I'm firing my weapon. It gets even worse in case in point with a couple of builds. Like, there are a whole bunch of things that trigger off of gunfire. And you might think, oh, well, then that's a reason to make sure that your shots land. Well, a lot of them trigger off of firing the weapon, not hitting with the weapon. And so if you've got lightning bolts that strike nearby enemies, every time you pull the trigger and the lightning does vastly more damage than the bullets themselves, it doesn't matter where you're firing. And so consequently, I just find myself getting disengaged by the game visually and mechanically. It gets some things right. There's a lot to unlock. The unlocks come at a pretty good pace. You have a very low number of hit points. And so there is a certain sort of tension early on in the game about avoiding things, because you only get hit around three or four times before you die, as opposed to having a large number of hit points and it kind of gets drained in an abstract-y way. I sometimes felt, for example, in a lot of other Survivor games, Vampire Survivors especially, where I wouldn't know if grazing an enemy would just be, you know, 5% of my hit point bar or like 33% of my hit point bar, just because of the way damage works.
I had the same experience.
Yeah. I never had that problem in 20 Minutes Till Dawn because everything is very lethal. If you get hit by something, you lose a, there's a very clear visual feedback. There's a little pulse and it causes enemies to get shoved back a little bit. It's very clear when you've been damaged. I appreciated that. And I wish that more Survivor games would give you more distinct visual feedback that way, which makes it all the more disappointing that the visual feedback for almost everything else is so muted and muddied, both because of aesthetic choices and because of mechanical choices. So I was very disappointed by 20 Minutes Till Dawn, and I don't think I'm going to go back. I'm pretty much done with it. I'd rather go back and replay a Survivor game where I've unlocked everything already. I'd rather go back and do more Halls of Torment or Karate Survivor, frankly, because I felt what I was doing there mattered. I felt like I had to pay attention to what I was doing, as opposed to 20 Minutes Till Dawn, where it's just just a wash in grays, and all my auto summons are doing vastly more than I ever could, so it feels like I'm not really playing it. And that's by the standards of a Survivor auto battler, Caitlin. I'm saying it feels like I'm not really playing it.
It's interesting, because I'm looking at the Steam page right now, and the game looks good. Like, 20 Minutes Till Dawn has this, I know you said it's very muted and everything, but they definitely have an aesthetic that they stuck to, and it looks very pretty, but I can absolutely see, even from the clips on their Steam page, how it would be easy to kind of lose your character / lose the enemies among all of these bullets and everything that are flying around because of that aesthetic choice.
Thank you for raising the Steam page, Caitlin, because I have gone back to the Steam page a couple of times, and I watch their clips, and I wonder what game they're playing on those clips, because they show, like, for example, one of the little bits in the promo video is, you know, upgrade your weapon, and then it shows your core weapon doing something amazing. I've never seen any of my core weapons do anything remotely interesting.
Okay.
Like, the little set pieces that they show on the clips look vastly better than anything that I've experienced in the game. I don't know if I'm just playing it wrong. I don't know what's going on. Like, I finished levels. Yeah. It's not like I'm playing the baby version and the real version gets unlocked after you finished a run. I finished several runs. So maybe maybe I'm not playing right. I don't know. But I look at those videos on Steam and it does not resemble my experience of playing 20 Minutes Till Dawn.
Now that is a bummer.
So I went on to go replay something that I played a while ago, because playing Bonk's Adventure last week, again, my sincere apologies to our listeners from the UK. We are not indeed trying to make this an R-rated podcast, but nonetheless, it's what it's called. Playing Bonk's Adventure had me in the mood for a little bit more of good mascot platformers. And I've mentioned before, I've got a bit of a soft spot for Rayman. I don't know why, because Rayman as a character kind of looks like a parody of what a network exec would think would look cool in the 90s. Like, it's amazing he doesn't always have a skateboard or something. It's bizarre. Yeah. Like, it's
he
just
has
so
that
much
energy.
Yeah, but, and nonetheless, when I'm actually playing a good Rayman game, I'm thoroughly enjoying it, and I even have a certain degree of enthusiasm for the main character. But if you show me a still shot of Rayman, I'm like, ugh, stop trying so hard. And by the way, you're 30 years out of date. But in the middle of a game, it works. I don't know why. But Rayman Legends, which was the one that released in 2013, is aggressively enjoyable and full of so much charm. It actually makes me a bit of a completionist. Like, every level, I know, a little bit, which is so contrary to so many of my impulses. Every level, there's a certain number of teensies to liberate. And if I finish a level and I haven't liberated all the teensies, I'm going to play that level again and try to liberate more teensies.
Yeah.
And there's medals to be won based on how many lums you accumulate. Don't ask, they're adorable. I may use a proper noun again in the context of Rayman that you're unfamiliar with. Don't ask, they're adorable. And if I don't get the gold medal for getting 600 lums, I'm like, I'm gonna replay that. I'm gonna see if I can get the 600 lums. And I'd completely forgotten, until I loaded up the first couple levels, that is, of arguably one of the best levels in all of platforming. Did you ever play any of the rhythm game levels of Rayman Legends?
So it's been a long time. I don't remember any particular parts of the game, but I did finish it back in the day.
Okay. So in the first world, the last level is called Castle Rock, and it is effectively turns Rayman into a rhythm game. And the level is done to the music of sort of a cover of the in-universe characters doing a performance of Black Betty. And it is, I sincerely believe, one of the greatest platforming levels I've ever played in my life. If you have access to Rayman Legends, I recommend you fire it up. play Castle Rock. If you have no access to Rayman Legends, look for Castle Rock Black Betty on YouTube. And if you can play that level without smiling once, then I would begin to question your humanity, because it is so incredibly charming. And I was in a little bit of doldrums. I'd been bouncing off a whole bunch of different games. I'd been coming to terms with the fact that some of my beat-em-ups that I enjoyed playing really fall apart near the end, specifically Sengoku 3, for what it's worth. It kind of turns into a bit of a slog. And it's like, ugh, I'm not really enjoying many of these things. Ooh, Rayman Legends. And I've just been replaying it and having such a good time doing so. I initially played it, I think, when it was free on PlayStation or something. I don't know. But Rayman Legends is amazing. Highly recommended. Castle Rock, one of the best levels ever. Go check it out.
I think I picked up Rayman Legends with my Wii U. I don't know if it was one of the launch titles or not. But anyway, I played it on the Wii U, and I had never played a Rayman game before, but it was so fun. I was really surprised because I didn't think I was going to enjoy it because I'm shallow and I looked at the main character and I was like, uh-uh. But
can't blame you.
It was delightful. So that kind of makes me want to play it again.
I did not play the Wii U version, but I'm actually a little bit envious because some of the gimmicks of the Wii U version seem actually relatively well implemented.
Okay.
They've actually ported some of the same. So there's basically, there's a little magical frog. It's complicated, don't ask. That kind of helps you on some of the levels. And in the context of the platforms that don't have any touch support, you know, like the PC version, like the PS3 version, like a variety of other versions, they've found a way to simplify it where you're just doing a button press and the frog will contextually know what to do. But in the context of touch-enabled ones, like the Vita version did this as well, the Wii U version, you actually have to swipe it across the screen at various moments, either in a co-op mode, two-player, or in the single-player mode. And frankly, I could imagine that being done very, very well. I don't have any personal experience with it, but the level design was definitely meant to take advantage of those things.
Yeah, I wish... this is going to sound funny. I wish my brain were a little different, because obviously, I played this 10-plus years ago. I remember loving it, but I cannot remember a single thing about it. Like, it just immediately got ejected from my brain. Like,
it's not what you would call a narrative-heavy experience, and the universe is obviously absurd.
Yeah.
The only thing that I remembered, for what it's worth, I played Rayman games more recently than 10 years ago. I vaguely remember what the glow box was. I don't think I remember what lums were called. I couldn't remember that the big nose things are called teensies. You know, you forget a lot of things. It's just, you know, there's this guy. His name's Rayman. He doesn't have limbs. Don't ask him. Don't ask. Don't worry about it. He has helicopter hair. It's okay. Just go with it.
Yeah.
It's Rayman. What do you want?
All right. With that, we can move on to our gaming opinions on old school funware segment, a.k.a. Goof. Today, we're going to be talking about Secret of Evermore, which was released in 1995 for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, and it was developed by Square. One of the unique things about it is that it was actually developed by Square USA, so it was developed in the United States. I don't remember like which studio it was in the US, but yeah, it was actually a USA first game. I don't think it ever even was released in Japan. Some people thought that this was our version of the next Secret of Mana. It really wasn't, but, you know, they named it Secret of Evermore for reasons. So here we are.
Instead of Secret of Evermore, they could have called it Legend of Saga of Journey of Evermore. Would that have been better?
Yeah. Well, maybe not. But this is one of my nostalgia games. So I had played Secret of Mana long before. Or maybe not long before. I played it before I played Secret of Evermore. And you might think by the fact that they're both from Square and that they have similar names, that they are at all similar. I mean, you walk around on a map and you can hit things with your weapon. That's accurate. They have the same kind of radial menu. So when you hit Y to like bring up your menu, you know, you can. That is exactly the same in both games. There's not a whole lot else that's super similar.
Okay, this actually makes me feel a lot better. I find this excellent validation for the idea that so many of these titles are interchangeable when you observe that there's this commonality in the naming scheme, but no similarity in terms of gameplay. Yeah. So thank you for that.
Yeah, anytime. So, yeah, I I played a decent amount of this. Actually, this brings me back. So a few weeks ago, we talked about my gaming setup. I finally got my Super Nintendo and a few other things plugged in. I tried to play Secret of Evermore with one of my old, like, actual SNES controllers. Okay, first of all, TV's big. I couldn't sit far enough away from it, but I was sitting as far as I could. You know, because the cables, the controller cords just weren't that long back then. Sure. And I don't have an extender. But I was sitting as far away as I could. And then my cats decided to get into a play fight and decided to run over my controller cord, tripping over it, yanking the controller out of my hands, yanking the Super Nintendo onto the floor.
Oh,
it
no.
crashed the game.
So I was like, no.
So anyway, I ended up investing. I mean, not much of an investment. I think it cost $30. I bought a wireless controller for the SNES from 8BitDo or 8BitDo.
There's a great deal of disagreement about how to pronounce it. Yes.
Okay. It was amazing. Life-changing. Perfect. I sat on my couch the correct distance away from the TV. I was able to play. It was beautiful. So anyway, yeah, got that whole thing set up. Very fun.
Parenthetically, on that topic, dear listeners, we would remind you that we have a Patreon. Come support us on patreon.com/amfad. Caitlin needs more controllers. She's going to need wireless versions for like 10 different consoles. This is going to add up.
So many different consoles. Yeah, so, I mean, okay. I have a lot to say about this game.
Sock it to us.
I'll start with the good stuff. There's still a lot that I love about it. I love that you have your dog and that it changes appearance depending on what era you're in, because you go to, I think, 4 distinct eras in this game. You have, like, the prehistoric one. You have one that's, like, kind of ancient Greece-ish called Nobilia. There's one that's, like, medieval times Europe. I forget what the name of that one is. And then there's a far future one. And your dog changes depending on what world you're in, which is kind of neat. And in general, your dog is a very good boy. So, love all of that.
But you know it's a retro game because you cannot pet the dog.
You cannot pet the dog. That is true. In fact, I'm not sure I ever saw him pet the dog. Maybe at the very beginning. I'm not sure. But you can level up your weapons. Eventually, you'll get different charge levels. You can hold in the B button to charge it up and then do a big attack. And that can be fun. But this game might not be as good as I remember it being.
Why do you say that, Caitlin?
Okay, so Secret of Evermore. needing to wait between every attack sucks, because you have your stamina and you do a swing. It doesn't matter when you do the swing. You will instantly go down to 0 stamina and you have to watch it count back up to 100. It doesn't take that long, but it's long enough that you attack and then you have to run away while your stamina recharges back to 100. Because if you attack earlier, you do an incredibly weak wet noodle hit. So you really needed to get to 100% in order to be able to do anything. Boss fights are so long. I was fighting a snake and I legitimately thought it should have died probably halfway through that fight. But it just kept going and going and going. I thought it would never die. There's spells that you can cast using alchemy, but in order to do that, you use actual ingredients. So your spells all have charges based on the amount of crap that you happen to find. And your dog can help you find stuff by sniffing out ingredients, but it's so tedious. It takes forever. You don't find enough of a given ingredient to make it worth it. So there's just so many flaws. And then, like, coming after Secret of Mana, which, again, the name similarity, Secret of Mana let you play the other characters in co-op if you wanted to. You cannot do that in Secret of Evermore. No one can control the dog. Well, okay, you, as the single player, can control the dog if you want. You can hit select to alternate between the boy and the dog. But not allowing for co-op play felt like a big misstep.
I agree entirely. Yeah. Like, you've taken the words right out of my mouth. It takes a lot for an action RPG to make me say, maybe this should have been turn-based. Because, frankly, the whole timing system is so... you're exactly right. It may not seem like much, but it makes it so tedious. And you say, between hits, you need to run away. I think what you meant to say was you have to walk away, because if you run, that resets your endurance again.
You're right. So, you're absolutely right.
So what could have been a dynamic, adventuresome romp ends up being this slog. So much seems tedious, which is a shame, because there's a lot of charm to be had in mm-hmm. Secret of Evermore. I actually laughed out loud at the reveal of the leader of the first village. You're wandering around in this prehistoric village, and you encounter somebody, and they say, oh, Fire Eyes is our leader. Fire Eyes runs this village. Like, oh, Fire Eyes, okay. You encounter someone else who says, Fire Eyes taught me everything there is to know about hunting, about herbs, and about the metric system. I'm like, what? And then you go to the leader's hut. All the villagers surround you, and everyone, they start chanting, Fire Eyes, Fire Eyes, Fire Eyes. I'm like, all right, some stuff's about to go down. And this 8-year-old girl with Coke bottle glasses emerges with pigtails. She's like, I'm Fire Eyes. This is my village. I'm like, this game is bonkers, and I love it. And
yes.
Then came the massive disappointment. Like, there's a lot of charm. There's a lot of personality. And because, again, when I go to a Square product in the 1990s, I'm not expecting a whole heck of a lot, frankly, in terms of personality. I expect it to be well-crafted, but I don't mm-hmm. necessarily for it to evoke a certain narrative tone, right? If you want to put a spectrum of narrative tone where on one end you have Disco Elysium, and on the other hand you have Final Fantasy, well, on the other end is Final Fantasy. And I apologize for alienating all the Final Fantasy stands out there, but you know what I'm getting at. But Secret of Evermore was very charming. I was even willing to forgive the fact that the main character, in the desperate attempt for them to hammer home his one personality trait, kept constantly quoting sci-fi B-movies. Like, we get it. Yes. Like science fiction movies. Real people don't talk like that, but okay, fine. You're painting a picture. Yeah. You're setting a stage. All right, okay, fine, cool. I was even willing to forgive that the main character is obviously a poor Michael J. Fox ripoff from the Back to the Future movies. He's dressed exactly the same as Marty McFly. There is no difference. He's wearing a red puffy vest and jeans. I'm sorry. It's obvious. And I was into it. I was so into it until they actually had me play the real game.
Yeah.
And here I am wandering around with a bone, trying to avoid those effing sand pits, which you can only do by running. Oh, but you're out of juice now. You're too tired. Oh, here's another sand pit. Screw you. Can I attack somebody? Oh, no. I missed the bug because the perspective
is a
weird isometric thing. Okay. Oh, yep. Now I'm in line. Oh, but my endurance isn't high enough. Okay, wait. Oh, now I'm at 90. Oh, I hit it at 95. Oh, crap. I didn't do any damage. Ugh. So tedious.
You mentioned missing. That actually brings me back to my previous rant, where I was talking about how long it takes, you know, for you actually be able to hit something. I feel like you miss at least 30% of the time. The accuracy, like, not even miss, like, oh, I just whiffed. Like, no, you should have hit it, except it missed. Like, as in, the game decided that it didn't do any damage. And it's like, oh my god, I can't. Like, I just waited. And sometimes there's multiple attacks that you do, and all of them miss. And it's incredibly frustrating. And granted, I don't think spells miss, but you have to level them up for them to be able to do any significant amount of damage. And it's... yeah.
Honestly, if they had taken... I was thinking about this. If they had taken Secret of Evermore and they've grafted on to Illusion of Gaia's combat engine or something similar, this could have been a real winner. I could have had such a hot time with this. I would have even preferred Secret of Evermore, as I said, if it were the same setting, the same characters, if they just made it a turn-based combat system. I would have preferred that, frankly.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's an example of how not to do action RPG systems, I think.
Yeah, like, I mean, they just made everything take longer for no reason, and it didn't feel strategic. Like, I could see it adding an element of strategy, but it didn't feel like it did. It felt like it just made everything take longer, and it made fights tedious, and fighting should be fun in a game where that's your main way of playing.
Now, I didn't come to this game with a preconceived notion on this topic, but having played Secret of Evermore, I am beginning to suspect that there may be shortcomings to America First.
Yeah, maybe.
Anything else to level at Secret of Evermore's feet, Caitlin? I think you covered it pretty exhaustively. Well done, by the way.
Yeah, no complaints. Just little notes. I mean, I love, there were a number of fun Easter eggs in this. Other than, of course, the various sci-fi B-movie references that the main character likes to make all the time. I guess there's also a couple cameos of Final Fantasy VI characters, like Realm, the artist character. She's apparently in the audience of something later on. There's also this prophet slash doomsayer in the second area, where if you talk to him repeatedly, he'll eventually be like, "We're all in a video game," and he tells you to strike him down if he's lying. And you can, like, you can choose to turn him into a goat, a chicken, or a basket. Like, can you imagine? Like, a basket? That is an inanimate object. But you can also choose to spare him. And if you spare him, you'll get some money or some armor. So, I don't know. I thought that was a cute touch. The Secret of Evermore has a lot of personality. I just wish that the combat were different than it is.
Yeah, it is really cute. It's just let down by its underlying mechanisms.
Yeah.
So that's Secret of Evermore. Now we're going to take a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, "Ahoy!" or "Land ho!" and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, "Shiver me timbers!" and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
And we're back. And now we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Hyper Light Drifter. Hyper Light Drifter was developed by Heart Machine, released in 2016. It was an indie darling and still is, and is now available for pretty much every platform imaginable. There have been ports throughout the years. Caitlin, why don't you tell us all about Hyper Light Drifter?
Okay, so I'm going to preface this with saying that I did not get to play as much of this as I would have liked. I had a lot of work, and then I brought my Steam Deck with me, and I had this grand idea that I was going to bring my sister to the vet, and then I was going to sit in the car for 2 hours while I waited for her to finish at the vet.
Your sister goes to a vet? I knew healthcare was messed up in your state, but I didn't know it was...
So, while she was there with her two dogs...
That makes much more sense.
Yes, with her dogs. I, you know, picked up the Steam Deck. I just charged it earlier in the day. I installed Hyper Light Drifter. I was ready. Except I was like, oh... But I probably have a cloud save.
Yes and no. Yeah, I discovered this as well a different way. So Caitlin told me this story before. Apparently, she spent a long time trying to get the Steam Deck hooked up to the internet to try to access what she expected to be a cloud save. A Hyper Light Drifter doesn't do cloud saves, which is just a throwback to an earlier time where cloud saves were the exception rather than the rule. I don't know what proportion of games had them in 2016, but Hyper Light Drifter does not. At least the Steam version does not. The more modern ports for Switch and mobile versions, who knows? But the one that we played, no such luck.
Yeah, so I had this grand plan that I was going to play, and so I was trying to connect to my mobile hotspot in order to, you know, hopefully get my cloud save. And then I was reading forums trying to figure out why I couldn't connect to my hotspot. Anyway, long story short, one of the things that I tried was to log out so I could log back in, except I couldn't get internet, so I was never able to log back in. And ultimately, if I had just sat down and played the game, I could have gotten much further in Hyper Light Drifter than I did on my home PC, but I didn't do that. So anyway, here we are. Hyper Light Drifter.
Well, we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about Undertale, right? Undertale was released in 2015, which is just a year before Hyper Light Drifter. It is easy to forget how far and how mainstreamed indie games have come since then.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, we can think of older stuff, you know, Braid, even Limbo, Cave Story, stuff like that. But honestly, 10 years ago, indie games were still very much on the periphery, whereas now it's thanks in no small part to the catastrophic failure of the AAA gaming industry to prove itself to be sustainable, reliable, or trustworthy. Indie games are now just, we don't even make a hard and fast distinction. It's just another game, such that, you know, Balatro can be a mainstream game of the year as well as the indie game of the year. That kind of sort of makes sense. The kind of sort of points to the absurdity of it. So when I saw that there were no cloud saves for Hyper Light Drifter. I was surprised, but when I remembered when it was released, I guess I wasn't shocked. It was just a nice little reminder of what we take for granted now, just in terms of technology, but in terms of indie game development.
Yes, for sure. But Hyper Light Drifter has an amazing sense of style. I think that the graphics are, I mean, it's all pixel graphics, but they're beautiful. You get to see this really lovely pixel cutscene as you start the game for the first time. I mean, there's almost no text anywhere in Hyper Light Drifter, which I thought was really neat. When you talk to NPCs, you are shown your conversation in pictures, which I thought was a very interesting and unique choice.
I'm of two minds. It's weird. Why don't you say more about what it's like to inhabit the world of Hyper Light Drifter?
I don't have a whole lot of context, again, because I was pretty early on. But, you know, early on, you start it up, you watch through the first cutscene, your character's coughing up blood, they get rescued by some person who I only know of as a stranger, because I've only seen them one other time in this game, in Hyper Light Drifter. But anyway, you're rescued, you start back in town, and then as you walk around and try to speak to others, I mean, you walk into a store and you try to buy something, and it's like, oh, I don't know, there's this square thing, and apparently you don't have it. So, okay, cool, I don't have the square thing, I guess I'll have to go find a square thing or two. So you leave, you try to talk to some NPCs, and they're like, yeah, here is a picture, and it's of a monster. And maybe sometimes you'll get a picture of something that looks vaguely map-ish. But It's weird. Like, it feels like it takes a little getting used to. I'm so used to, you know, you talk to an NPC and they're like, oh yeah, to the east, there's a snake monster. You don't explicitly get that here.
Is that your NPC impression?
Yes.
Okay. That was great. I would nominate you for Golden Globe.
Oh, thank you.
In isolation, I very much appreciate the sort of elliptical storytelling that Hyper Light Drifter is doing. In context, I find it one more piece of a pattern that kind of annoys me, because we've talked about two of these things before. In the context of Animal Well, if you remember, I complained about how the way that level design works is it exploits the visual ambiguity of its level design so as to hide secret paths.
Mm-hmm.
Hyper Light Drifter does that all the time. Is this a tree whose foliage I can walk behind, sort of mimicking the fact that this is an isometric perspective and that the leaves at the top of a tall tree will not block my progress? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Better go find out. The map is deliberately bad. I don't think there's any bones about this. Like, we talked about the map in Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, and there I just felt it was trying its best, but it didn't quite communicate exactly enough about the level so as to be able to backtrack effectively. In the case of Hyper Light Drifter, it's deliberately bad. It's deliberately opaque. It's deliberately unclear. And when you add to that all the fact that, you know, even these merchants won't tell you what's going on, you don't know what you're buying even. You get this vague sense of a currency that you don't have enough of. But then when you do, and you're going to shop, the game is trying to kind of sort of tells you what it does, but not really. Now, every once in a while, the game actually tutorializes you. And there it's fine. Press A to dash. Okay, cool. When you pick up a second gun, it tells you how to switch guns. It knows how to do this. It just doesn't want to most of the time. And the thing is, I honestly don't get the vibe of mystery and adventure. I think it's because the map was the one step too far. Because the amount of backtracking you have to do in Hyper Light Drifter, this is solidly in like the Zelda paradigm, right? You've got this overland map, there are bits of combat, but you're going from place to place, and something's got unlocked, and maybe you unlocked it then, you're not sure, something happened, something changed in the map, why don't you go check that door? Oh, it's still locked. Okay, why don't you go check that other thing you couldn't progress past before? Wait, where was that in the map? I can't see. Okay, I guess I'm just hoofing it then. Etc, 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 right?
Yeah. And
it's at that point that I lost patience with the storytelling. The storytelling by itself, I might have been fine with.
Yeah.
Legitimately. Because, I mean, comparing it to Elden Ring, for example. When you go and talk to somebody in Elden Ring, they use English words. But they're gibbering nonsense, and you don't know what the hell they're talking about. right? So in a very real sense, sometimes the dialogues you have in Hyper Light Drifter are more illuminating, or at least more transparently obvious or intelligible than the dialogues you have in Elden Ring.
Yeah.
But Elden Ring wasn't fighting me the rest of the way, as an example. So I don't know why I wasn't as willing to give Hyper Light Drifter a pass. But again, I think it was just an accumulation of small things, and the map was the thing that finally pushed me over, given how much backtracking I had to do.
Yeah, that is understandable.
It is beautiful, though. You do find these, like, every once in a while, you have what would pass for a cutscene, but is far more sparse and efficient in Hyper Light Drifter. Like, you get to a new screen for the first time, and the camera moves over, and it shows some incredible vista of some weirdness that is kind of past explanation. Whether it's a decaying hulk or weird bit of machinery or some sort of skeletal giant, I don't know. Just a whole bunch of weird stuff. And it's like, oh, that's really cool and well done. All right. But that doesn't have to make sense. It's fine. But when I need to remember where the locked door is, now that I think I might or may not have a key, spoiler alert, you don't. I lose a lot of my patience.
That's understandable, because I actually, while playing Hyper Light Drifter, it brought to mind a lot of kind of Dark Souls, Demon Souls style storytelling, where you just see something and you know that something crazy happened there at some point in the past, but you don't really know exactly what. I mean, you barely even know what's happening with your own character, other than that they're coughing up blood and, you know, this big scary thing shows up sometimes. The other side of it, though, being that you don't get clarity from almost anything is challenging.
I bought an upgrade for my movement capabilities for your dash, because dashing in Hyper Light Drifter is strangely clumsy in a lot of ways. Like, it's one of those things where there's a cooldown and it's not particularly long, but it's slightly longer than you might expect. Like, for example, it's roughly twice as long as the cooldown for your dash in Hades. So I bought what I thought was a triple dash.
Uh-oh.
I thought I could dash three times in succession, because that's what the little video at the vendor seemed to imply. I literally have no idea what it is that I purchased.
Oh no.
I decided if I'm going to experience Hyper Light Drifter, I wasn't going to look up any walkthroughs. I wasn't going to look up any tutorials. I was going to try to immerse myself in the mystery and the elliptical storytelling. But quite frankly, I never felt more inclined to go find a guy than just say, what did I just buy? How does it work? Is it working? I don't know if it's working. Am I doing it? Am I crumping now? I don't think I'm crumping now. What's going on?
I think that the way that they decided to do storytelling was cool. And I think I definitely could have been into it if there had been just a little bit more structure around it to make me feel like I knew what was going on.
Oh, there's a structure. It's just not going to make anything clear to you.
Sure. Did
you ever play the game Tunic?
Yes.
I got strong Tunic vibes from Hyper Light Drifter, and not in a good way. I did not enjoy Tunic. I admired what Tunic was trying to do. Tunic is, again, deliberately obscure. You're literally, over the course of the game, trying to build the instruction manual for this game that you're playing.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, that's neat. I don't think I'll enjoy it. Sure enough, I didn't. It's it is unclear and vague in a lot of ways that I don't enjoy. But I was reminded an awful lot of Tunic while playing Hyper Light Drifter.
Yeah, and that could be a great, like, Tunic was very well loved. That could be a great thing for a lot of people.
It's true.
Not Mark.
Now, what I was expecting, in part based on the press and things that I'd heard about Hyper Light Drifter over the years, was something more along the lines of a game like Fury or a game like Sifu. Because what people often talk about is the very challenging, very fast-paced combat in Hyper Light Drifter. And sure enough, the combat is well-designed and interesting and very thin on the ground. And what I found particularly unfortunate was that, unlike a lot of other very challenging combat games, I'll throw Elden Ring into the mix for this, is that in games of that ilk, if you're not paying attention, if you're not careful, random mooks can and will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the world is really deadly, and you have to always be on your guard. Anything and everything can bring you low if you're not good enough, or if you're not prepared for the particular combat challenge. Hyper Light Drifter, if anything, the combat was really cool, and it was stylish, and it was well done, and mechanically it was solid, but I felt that the random encounters were not particularly challenging. Like, you could just be stupid and slash your way through, because there's lots and lots of health drops all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. But it what it does is it doesn't train you to go beat the bosses, because the bosses will kill you. The boss encounters are really well done, very challenging, again, mechanically very satisfying, and an order of magnitude more difficult than anything else you've experienced up to that point. And so I would be there, like, trying the boss for the fourth, fifth, sixth time to get past, like, this is really well done. Shame the rest of the game isn't like this, and it's a shame it hasn't been training me to do this, because I feel like I've been playing a different game this entire time. When, again, if you compare it to something like Fury or Sifu or even Elden Ring, every combat encounter is really challenging, and so you're constantly being tested. Whereas Hyper Light Drifter, the combat was always fun.
Yeah.
But I felt like there was a strange disconnect going on even there.
Okay, yeah, I wish that I had seen one of the boss encounters, because I did not get that far in Hyper Light Drifter. And it would have been really interesting to see the difference between that and the regular encounters like you just described.
Well, how did you find the combat?
I had a hard time getting used to the controls, and I don't know if it's just because I was, you know, switching between games too much or something, but I kept forgetting that I had a gun. But I mean, I thought that the normal slash and dodge stuff was really well done. I was able to pretty quickly pick up on all the different enemies' like movements and know, you know, when this weird plant monster is about to attack me and stuff like that. I thought all of that was really well done. It would have been nice to see a bit more of it, I think.
So the sort of conceit about the interplay between gunplay and swordplay, again, somewhat reminiscent of the game Fury, is that your gun only regenerates ammo when you use your sword. So if you empty your clip, or indeed if you're just a few rounds short, then you regenerate ammo by hitting things with your sword. And so what it encourages, at least in theory, is a dynamism between different combat styles and being able to seamlessly transition between swordplay and gunplay. Now, to a certain extent, I didn't feel that dynamism until I found the second gun. The second gun was okay. Much more to my tastes, but that was just a gameplay style preference. I wasn't forsaking the gun previously, but the second gun I found much more to my play style. And the other thing is that the control scheme does feel a little bit clumsy. Like, I can't help but feel, again, that if this were a game that were released contemporarily, if this were a, you know, 2024 or 2025 release, the gun, to fire the gun, you would aim with the right stick and fire with R2. You wouldn't hold down L2, aim with the left stick, and fire with R2, and be forced to stand immobile while aiming.
I kept forgetting how to aim. Like, especially in combat, it just wasn't working for me.
It's just one press too many. It's just, it's not, again, in 2016, maybe it felt less clumsy, but it's not in keeping with standard expectations. And again, given the pace of combat, even when I felt it was a little too easy, basically, the reason why I feel like a standard combat encounter is a little too easy is because you can, at various points, just stand there and mash the attack button and get by, right? In a lot of other highly demanding combat games, you just cannot do that flat. You will get destroyed. There's just enough health drops that you can get away with doing that a lot of the time, which is okay. It's fine. I'm not saying that it needed to be much more difficult. I'm just saying that the gulf between the difficulty between the boss encounters and the normal encounters is so huge that it's a little jarring. And I like the engine. And as you say, the enemies are great. They're well done. They're well animated. They telegraph their attacks just the right amount. But when backtracking, and again, I was doing a lot of backtracking, you know, the combat encounters, they weren't plentiful enough or engaging enough to really make me feel like I was doing anything other than just laboriously going from point A to point B just to test another locked door. Maybe that's more a problem of my expectations, though, because again, the thing that I always hear about is how hard the combat is in Hyper Light Drifter. And I guess most people are just mostly talking about the boss encounters, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really wish I would have seen one. I'm not going to put this game down quite yet, so I'll get to it eventually, along with all the other things I'll eventually get to, hopefully before I die.
You see, if you hadn't added that proviso, that intent to go back to it, I would have been able to finally deploy something to you, Caitlin, that you do to me all the time. I could have told you to get good. Alas, my comeuppance will have to wait for another day.
It will. It's okay.
Yeah, so I'm a little disappointed by Hyper Light Drifter. I wanted something like Sifu or something like Fury, but instead I got something more like Zelda, which is all right. but very much not what I was in the mood for. And if I'm going to play a game like Zelda, I want a better map. I want a better inventory management system. I want to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it is impressive in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I can especially see why in 2016 it made waves.
So that is Hyper Light Drifter. We are now going to move on to some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So today I'm going to shout out Stage Fright. It's by the same developer as Overcooked. Apparently it's a co-op with some escape room style cooperation involved. So I don't know. I loved Overcooked and I'm excited to see what Stage Fright is like. From the trailers I saw, it looked like it might only be two player instead of four. But I'm hoping that I can wrangle my spouse into playing it with me.
What was Overcooked?
Overcooked was that like frantic, everybody is playing a chef and you're making stuff for people who are doing orders in your restaurant. I don't know if you would have seen it.
Oh, I've got some friends that play this. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's one of those, Overcooked is one of those games where if you have similar personality types, I think it can work really well, but I think it also could easily break up friendships and or marriages, given the chance.
Okay, so it's a relationship stress test is what I'm hearing.
Yes, not unlike Mario Party or, what was it, Super Mario Brothers Wii, or I don't know. One of those ones where you can actually collide with other people playing and fall to your death and then get mad at them, blah, blah, blah.
This from someone who plays Helldivers on the reg.
Yes, yes.
Are you more willing to forgive it when it's an airstrike or a war crime, but less willing to forgive it
because then it's hilarious.
All right, I would like to shout out something with a very strong proviso attached. That is Valkyrie Squad Siege Breakers. This is going to be launching in early February, so it might already be out by the time you hear this. It is a survivor-type thing with a fair bit of character and personality, and you select a squad of three characters, and you can swap between them at any time. And I've played the demo, and it has a number of virtues about it. Number one, the special abilities are really cool. Number two, the things that show up on the map are of consequence. Like, you can go chase down and bust down a building to get a health drop, or you can go liberate other squad members that then give you a buff for a while. I have a serious misgiving about the cast. It leans heavily towards scantily dressed anime women, and I'm not down for that. But I'm cautiously optimistic that the game will not spend too much time dwelling on that. I don't know. I had a good time with the demo. I just breezed past the character select screen as quickly as I could because it was kind of juvenile and embarrassing. But we'll see. I'm always on the lookout for a new survivor-type game, and as I just talked about this week, I'm coming hot off the heels of a disappointment. So when and if it goes on sale, I might give a try to Valkyrie Squad Siege Breakers.
Yeah, it looks really neat. I can see what you mean about the character design. On the Steam page under About This Game, there's a banner with the seven playable characters that all look like they are women in, you know, sci-fi-ish outfits.
Tactical bathing suits is, I think, the term you're looking for.
Yeah, tactical bathing suits sounds about right.
Science fiction tactical swimwear is very much the mode. Yeah, the About This Game banner, I think, is a pretty good evocation of the character design. In the middle of the game, you don't really have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But as I say, the character select screen was the primary offender. Other than that, playing the game was kind of fun. Yeah.
Nice.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you all for joining us for All My Best Friends Are Digital. We hope to see you again soon. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we hope that you enjoy your video game time in the interim. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.